Hi, anyone? Anyone at all? I'm Joshua Hansen Clark with Infinite Scroll Media Services and Productions, and this is And the Beans Talk, our variety show, where we will be presenting short pieces in various languages and also serializing our own original fiction. So, what is Infinite Scroll? Well, at its core, our work here is a celebration of the public domain, that huge, messy mass of material which contains everything written before the 20th century and some of the stuff written since. Obviously, the further back you go, the less there is to draw from, but there is also a scientific tradition that attempts to develop a sense of what the world was like outside of the written record. So, I've never taken coherent notes in my life. I mostly, like, copy stuff out, like, entire texts directly, but I appreciate and try to consult the scientific literature as best I can. So, who am I, and what do I do? Well, I am a digital scribe, so to speak. I copy standardized classic texts from hundreds of years ago, set them on pages with basic 1-inch margins and 12-point font, and at that point I'm very controlling of page breaks. I have a pagination system with very specific rules about how much of a paragraph can be broken off to the next page, 4 lines minimum, which is high. Those page breaks then trigger probability mechanisms that are always operating under the surface of your basic word processing software, such as Google Docs or Word, to aleatorically determine the shape of the text on the page. It's standard in the publishing world to insert marginal hyphens that break words up on the right side to save space, and then to justify the text so it all lines up with that right margin. I don't do that. I prefer to let it have an ugly, ragged edge on the right. It's aesthetically appealing to me, and it's part of, you know, the chance-based methodology. I also don't introduce marginal hyphens, partly out of laziness, since it means consulting dictionaries a lot, and adjusting the hyphenation later on if something were to change. However, I do include the marginal hyphens from the original printings because they have educational value. They break words up syllabically, at least according to the conventions of the time. I also include page numbers from the original printings as well, since I'm very interested in how texts shift and change, adapting like liquids to their containers, with the content remaining the same. So, like our other podcast, Spitting Dust, we will be reading old material in its original form, its original language, and commenting on it. But here, we'll be focusing on shorter pieces, while with Spitting Dust, we want to carve out space for long-form recitation of classic material, of Homer and Hesiod, the Hebrew and Greek Bibles, the Latin classics, and so on through the medieval period, consulting their corresponding translations as needed. For this show, since we're looking at shorter pieces, particularly at folktales, we have more time to look at various translations in detail. The major modern folktale compilers that come to mind are the Grimm's in German, 1810s through the 1850s, Croker in Irish English, 1820s, Asbjørnsen and Moe in Norwegian, 1840s, Afanasiev in Russian, 1850s to the 60s, and Calvino in Italian, 1950s. All of these editors are vintage literature bros who thought and often said dumb shit, and just because we're reading their work doesn't mean we'll be approaching it uncritically. Italo Calvino seems to kind of represent almost the culmination of this type of literary artist, and when you read the introduction to Italian folktales, you can see that bro-y attitude play out. which then surfaces in the texts themselves. The tales range in length from single paragraphs, sometimes only a few lines, to dense multi-page mini-epics, and the books end up establishing somewhat coherent shared universes by the simple accumulation of material and detail. The peasants and nobles, human and animal, who wreak bloody havoc on each other over millions of words and thousands of pages, they establish themselves as poorly aged satirical tropes that are themselves ripe to be satirized anew. As we go through this process, we'll also meditate on the unrecorded oral tradition that such material attempts to preserve. Why are these stories like this? How did this style of storytelling emerge? These are questions that have always captivated scholars and that can really only be answered speculatively based on the data that we have, which is why I use the verb meditate to describe how the approach we'll be taking to that side of it. So the fountainhead for this tradition appears to be Aesop, the Greek figure Aesopos. But the problem with Aesop is that, like Homer before him and Socrates after, we cannot actually confirm him as a historical individual. This uncertainty has led many scholars to be more comfortable talking about an Aesopic tradition rather than an individual. So rather than it being just one guy generating all this stuff, instead the stories are presumed to be written from many perspectives and over the course of a longer period of time. This seems perfectly logical, but even so, those three guys, Homer, Aesop, and Socrates, they persist in the imagination as individuals. I think it's easier for us to imagine one guy being extraordinary than a diverse many being extraordinary together, with all of the messiness and awkwardness that entails. We talk about fairy and folk tales being unrealistic, but when you approach them as a modern reader, the first two adjectives that come to mind to describe this stuff is messy and awkward. Occasionally upsetting also comes to mind. Is life not also, perhaps primarily, those three things? Something to think about, I don't know. So, obviously Aesop did not write exclusively about animals. You know, the fox and the eagle and the cat and the donkey and the goat and the camel and the monkey and the elephant, da-da-da-da-da. There's a lot of speculation about if Aesop was one guy, what led him to include these, where was he from? People speculate, oh, he could have been Ethiopian, an African man, a black man, which would definitely affect any reading of the stories, particularly a few of them. He also wrote about the gods and about humans, but is mostly remembered today for the animals. So that then leads into this huge tradition, not just in Europe, but we will be focusing mostly on European stuff because it's what I have the most ease with language-wise. So there's this huge tradition of using animals to satirically comment on the issues or trends of the day. Since we're focusing on short pieces here, we won't be looking at all of the so-called beast epic material, because it's long. And the longer parts of it are more appropriate to spitting dust than to hear. However, there are also short pieces as well. Aesop is written in miniatures. Everything is extremely short, almost never taking up more than one page. There are also some branches, some poems of the of Le Roman de Renart, which is a large old French compilation of fox versus wolf poems that are written in a fairly tight 8-syllable meter. There are a few of those that are short enough that we might read them here, but they're more obscure than the core narratives from that collection, so it's hard to find translations. It's kind of a catch-22. And then the same goes for some of the Latin writings, the Fabulae of Avianus, the Ecbasis Captivit of Wosaginus, and the Isengrimus of Niwardus, all of which are real works that I am not making up. The Fabulae are short enough to read here. Those are translations of Aesop's prose tales into Latin verse. It is also the earliest of these three works, the Ecbasis Captivit, the Escape of a Captive, is often considered the first beast epic. It's 1,000-something lines. Latin nerds will comment on the apparent incompetence of the author when it comes to handling declension or meter or whatnot, but I don't particularly, like, I can't read Latin directly. I need a, or any non-English language directly, I need to have a translation on hand, or else I won't know what's going on. So, as I'm going to expand upon in Spitting Dust, that puts me in an interesting position, and us culturally in an interesting position, because it means that the writing can exist for us as kind of abstract sound art. And I'll be kind of splitting the difference between abstract sound and storytelling for this, you know, this experimental series of podcasts. So, I would much rather read fun animal stories than Virgil and Ovid or whatever, though we will also be looking at them. The works I just mentioned, these are the beast epics, or the at least the core ones that I've found so far. Long-ass poems where the miniature Aesopic world of anonymous animals in small, specific circumstances with, like, a moral stated at the end, that format falls away, and it's replaced, it's blown out into this huge multilingual universe full of named characters: Isengrim the wolf, Noble the lion, Renard the fox, Chanticleer the cock, Tibert the cat, Bernard the mule, and so on and so on. It's like BoJack Horseman meets Game of Thrones. In fact, there's a very direct line of descent, or at least some very clear similarities between Renard the fox and BoJack. Renard, at least in the French tradition, is a parody of the philandering feudal nobleman who hides away in his magic castle rather than answer for his misbehavior. He is a predator in every sense of the word. The Greek, to go into word studies a little bit, the Greek for fox is Alopex, one of the most prolific figures in Aesop. Think of, like, the fox tricks the animals into doing stuff. That's his thing. He also complains about not being able to reach the grapes on the vine, and he's like, oh, they were probably sour anyway. And that's where we get sour grapes from. Da 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 da. Anyway, in the New Testament, Luke 13:32, Jesus calls Herod Antipas a fox, an alopex, in one of his most striking quotes. The passage is called, the section is the Lament over Jerusalem, and it begins with some Pharisees meeting with Jesus and informing him that Antipas, one of Herod the Great's sons, is out to kill Jesus, hiring assassins and stuff. In the Hebrew tradition, this is something that prophets have always had to worry about. The Hebrew Bible is an espionage epic, spies killing spies, and Jesus is stepping into this very politically charged space and coming from a rural working class background, like Amos, the great social justice prophet before him. In this scene, there's no indication of who these particular Pharisees are, which is unfortunately the norm for the Gospels, so we don't know if they had direct contact with Antipas or if they heard of this through the grapevine, but you can bet that they have skin in the game to some degree. So then Jesus tells them to go back to Antipas and epatete alopeki taute. You tell that fox, idu ekbalo daimonia. Behold, I cast out demons. Literally, I throw or toss out demons. And I am curing people, and I will complete the ultimate cure in a 3-day cycle, etc., etc. This is also the passage where he describes himself as a big chicken, attempting to shelter Jerusalem under his wings. Now, there are a lot of demons in the Gospels, but not so much elsewhere in the Bible. Demon possession is apparently a Greek import. You don't really see it in the Hebrew scriptures at all, except maybe for instances involving ruchot ra'ah, evil spirits, which when they appear are usually sent by Elohim, by God, like it's explicitly described in the text. Meanwhile, in the native Greek tradition, daimones aren't demons as we think of them. They're more like sentient ideas. The Olympian gods, it seems, are just extremely powerful and influential daimones. You can see it in their names, which today we think of as the names of distinct characters based on whatever our preferred adaptation of the lore happens to be, whether it's Percy Jackson or Disney's Hercules or whatever. But in Greek, they are just the mundane words for ideas, or sometimes constructed names based on like puns of varying obscurity. Most to all of that nuance is lost when we read English translations with our English assumptions. And this isn't just a problem with other languages translating to English. You already see it in the what's called the Metaphrasis ton Hebdomekonta, or the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Hebrew Bible, the first large-scale translation of Hebrew scripture into any other language. In Greek, the name Yehuda or Judah means nothing. In the Torah, it's given by Leah to mean one who praises, or something to that effect. As with all of Jacob's sons' names, there's a deep mystical meaning here that nerds have been racking their brains trying to figure out for millennia. But in the translation process, a problem arose with the names, because Greek does not have a letter that makes an H sound. There's a so-called rough breathing mark at the beginnings of certain words and names, such as Hera and Hephaestus and Hermes, but it's never inside of a word. So Yehuda becomes Iudas, completely eliminating that H sound, the Hebrew letter He. It bugs me so much when this happens that when I'm transliterating Jewish Greek, I actually go ahead and insert the little raised H that I use to indicate the rough breathing into the Greek versions of the name, wherever that sound happens to be missing. There's no academic justification for doing this, but I do it anyway because I can, except in cases where it just isn't possible, like when Methuselah becomes Mathusalas. So, to track the transformation of Yehuda to Judah, your first stop is Greek, Iudas. Next is Latin, which is the same, basically, Iudas. In German, it's Judas, spelled but not pronounced how we're used to seeing it. And then in French, it's Judas, taking that J sound for the first time. It was not there before. Then, and only then, in the English Bibles, does it become Judah in the Old Testament and Judas or Jude in the New. So you see how names that mean something in their source languages mutate and garble as they travel to other languages and become nonsense. I would like to close with another striking instance of animals and demons interacting in the Gospels, and it's the bizarre episode with the demon swarm entering the pigs. This is also a very political passage, but in a less clear way than just calling Herod Antipas a fox because he's a crafty, evil nobleman. This demon swarm speaks as a single, like, gestalt entity, legion or legion. This is, of course, a Latin word transliterated into Greek, and the legiones were the main ranks of the Roman army, some of which were, of course, stationed in Palestine at the time as an occupying force. They were cops enforcing an expansionist enterprise through violence and terror, just like they do today in any number of military and paramilitary organizations one could cite. So, if demons, daimones, represent cultural ideas, if they are, in fact, those ideas given some sort of form and voice, it's pretty clear right from the jump what Legion, the demon, represents. He represents the Roman occupation. This is where things get weird. In a scene that makes basically no sense, given the geography of the area or the durability of full-grown pigs, Legion the demon makes a deal with Jesus. Rather than being driven into the wilderness, the Eremos, as is usually the case for cast-out demons, I guess that's where they have their hives or something, Legion suggests that Jesus cast them into a nearby herd of grazing pigs. Jesus complies, and the herd runs off of a cliff and drowns. Thing is, there apparently are no cliffs on that side of the Galilean Sea, and the shock of reading about Jesus killing these pigs is such that commentators have bent over backwards for hundreds of years to explain what the hell is even happening here. But regardless of the logic of, or the moral calculus of the scene, it is the first instance that I know of cops, in this case Roman legionaries, being equated to pigs. It's a deeply satirical story that feels way ahead of its time. We call cops pigs today. And it's reinforcing the use of animals for satirical means that we see in Aesop and that we are going to see throughout history. These animals, the fabulistic animals, if you will, they eventually become the funny animals of the modern cartooning world. And then that tradition was corporatized by Disney, who then started pursuing an expansionist imperial drive of their own. So that again makes the tradition irresistible to the satirist, which leads to modern works like BoJack Horseman. Okay, so to close out our first episode here, I want to turn to the original content that we're going to be serializing here. I am currently in the process of writing a beast epic of my own with the satirical dimensions that I find inspiring. Because as I've been reading this stuff, you know, I've come to realize that anyone can do this. There's no limitation necessarily on who is and isn't allowed to make this kind of content. And as I've been reading the historical material, you know, there's a lot about it that I like and a lot about it that I just despise. And I expected that going in. But I didn't expect my personal feelings to be so extreme on both ends. And when I refer to the historical material, I'm talking about the beast epics from before, particularly the old French Roman de Renart. So, I am basically rebooting these characters, continuing to focus on the conflict between the fox and the wolf, but with my own take on like the dynamics of that relationship, because in the Roman, for example,
Eason Graham is pretty much completely justified in hating Renard. Renard is a criminal, and Renard sexually assaulted Eason Graham's wife, Hersent. So based on that crime, they go to court and they put in they try to bring Renard to justice, basically, and that sets off this not like a literal kangaroo court like with kangaroos, though that would be funny and I would like to make that joke at some point, but it's a sham trial. Renard refuses to show up. And the whole thing is played for laughs, and it's very distasteful for a modern reader. And it sheds light on what our ancestors found funny. They laughed at horrible things, and we still laugh at bad stuff today. So it's not exactly a surprise, but you get a bit more insight into how we became like this as a culture when you look at that old stuff. So in the interest of, you know, the increased sensitivity that we have today towards those issues, it was obviously not an option for me to take that same approach. So instead, I will be, I'm taking a, because I've always looked at history. I've always been fascinated by the calendar systems. Like I went through a period where I was really deep into the calendars, and I was studying them like in extreme detail, like as the various calendar systems compare to each other. And that's still like a system that I have mentally that's going all the time. So I'm going to be incorporating some of the lessons I learned from that into how I mark the chronology out over the course of my original narrative. So this is an early draft, I'm sure, of this episode of my work. I'm sure I'll be reworking this text and then reading it again, you know, later on down the line. Like one thing I can think of right now that I probably want to add is dates, because the narrative is on like a 6,000 year timeline that I'm not necessarily going to tell it linearly, but it's set in a talking animal world. There's no people. I made the choice to have no humans, and it's this fully populated like world that and like a fun silly idea that I came up with recently is that there's a lot of like advanced technology lying around that nobody knows how to use because it's ancient technology that was designed by the dinosaurs and that all fell into disrepair when the dinosaurs were doing like experiments on the nature of reality. They had an extremely advanced civilization, and one of these scientists ends up causing like a time crisis, basically, that causes reality to collapse and reboot. So that's kind of like the high concept that sort of guides the entire thing. But this episode does not have any dinosaur stuff in it. This is more focused on the specifically the she-wolf from the story of Romulus and Remus that Virgil tells in the Aeneid, with the famous image of the orphan babies being raised by this wolf. So here we go. I'm not sure about titles yet. I'm not sure what this is necessarily going to be. I'm basically workshopping this material in real time rather than, you know, working on it by myself until I'm sure it's done and then releasing it, because that's how I've always worked, and it's never gotten anything done. So there obviously needs to be like a change in my methods. So I'm just going to jump into this right now. They say she had no mother, that she clawed her way out of the earth, fully formed and snarling. But her early years are hazy at best, passed down via informal oral chronicles howled into the night. None of these various accounts agree, and it matters little. That's just her most popular origin story. All that matters is that she still walks among us, Lupa the Dictatrix, the first den mother, the grand old dam. Whether or not she was the first of all the wolves, she was the first of any note. She didn't need to take in those bees. What did it matter if there were two fewer bees in the world? The world would always have bees, right? Yet she saw something in them. The two abandoned larvae struggling in the mud, wings only just budding from grubby shoulders, abandoned by their hive. She named them Eklo and Filio. They taught her to buzz and fly, and in return she taught them to howl and kill. Later, after they had grown strong off of her milk and her wisdom, they would come to despise each other, as brothers so often do. This hostility turned murderous, and she found them again, dying and struggling. Filio was already gone, pinned into the earth with Eklo's stinger through his heart. Eklo had attempted to fly away victorious, but was now lying on the other end of a corkscrew string of guts. As he lay writhing, honey gushing from his wound, Lupa observes the chance arrangement of corpse, entrails, and killer, and she marvels at its artfulness. She has a vision of dice falling into a metal dish, their sides multiplying as they clang against its surface and knock against each other. "Don't move, son," she said. "I shall return with help, and you will live." She came back flanked by two of her associates, Tardis the Slow and Isen the Grim. Tardis was a chronopath of an even older vintage than she. The impossibly ancient snail floated on a cloud of slimy bubbles, which fizzed out from under his shell and collected beneath his glistening foot. Despite the name, he was a motormouth whose speech often dripped with contempt for those he deemed wise guys, scumbags, or powder poofs. Scumbugs, or powder poofs. It was unclear whether these terms were roughly synonymous, part of a coherent personal system of thought, or deployed at random based on his whim and mood. Isen, of course, needs little introduction. A wolf like Lupa, her closest confidant, an unpredictable agent of chaos, and one of the world's few proficient sarcopaths, who had recently gotten it into his head to become a performance poet. Upon their arrival to the scene, he was attempting to workshop an asinine bar about being in the mix, like shredded cheese bits falling into your cinnamon twists, or something to that effect. Tardis, who pioneered this style of poetry several centuries prior, simultaneously humored him and shut him up with a verse about how he was a bozo! Don't you know you'll stub your toe bones on Tardis the Slow's flow? Lupa, in the middle, contemplates suicide as she regrets her decisions. Eklo, still clinging to consciousness, coughs out a honey-choked laugh. Wow, old man, he sputtered. You fucking suck. Tardis hovers above Eklo, blowing a large bubble whose surface undulates like the sea as it grows. Yeah, laugh it up, kiddo, while we literally save your dumbass. Isen prowls around the two prone bees, marking out a perimeter as he goes. He sits proudly beside the impaled Filio. The bubble should be about this wide, Tardis. I definitely could have figured that out myself, without you stinking up the place, but all right.
I'm just helping. You're welcome.
Lupa steps on his tail, the pad of her paw heating up like a coal. Isen yelps. I brought you here for your mind, Isen, not your glands. You will await my word. At this point, if left alone, Eklo would have bled out in a few minutes. But Tardis had blown a bubble, within which minutes were taffy stretched into hours, and he lowered it onto the dying bee. Don't screw this up, Isen. I can only hold the bubble so long.
The bee in the dirty bubble. The babbling bee in big trouble. Blowing golden honey bubbles?
He trails off, uncharacteristically. Lupa turns to address him. Eason? It was a miracle. The wolf, no one could get to shut up, was now sitting calmly on his haunches, staring blankly ahead, past the scene before him, past the horizon. Eason? At that point, I've inserted a break, and then it goes into another section of text where Eason has a mysterious vision. I don't want to read everything right now. I want there to be something for next time. But yeah, that's my twisted little animal adaptation of Romulus and Remus. I hope people like this crap. I want there to be like a decent balance between darkness and silliness. That's what I've always liked about BoJack Horseman and how it's able to balance those extremes. And I don't know. I'm having fun creating this silly world, and I hope that other people can have fun visiting it. And thank you all so much for listening. This was our first episode of And the Beans Talk. I hope to actually get into a bit more material first, or next time. This time I basically wanted to kind of just get the basic themes and ideas out. And hopefully y'all are willing to join me next time. And we'll see where this goes. I'm excited. Thank you all so much. See you next time.